All right, well, we've been working our way through the book of Esther. Last week, we took a little bit of a break so we could hear from the Peters, which was an awesome chance to hear about their ministry and the things that they're doing in Spain. But we're back at it, and we're in a really great part of the story of Esther. Esther is one of those stories that really is the bad guy doing everything he can to take out the entire goodness of the world and seeming to pull all of these different players together to make that happen. And it seems like for a long time in the story, there's a lot of not good stuff going on. And it seems like the bad's going to win. But Esther's the greatest story ever because really God flips good and bad on its head and turns things around the way it's supposed to be by the end of the story, and that's why we love it. We love to see what God's going to do in a story and how God's going to turn things around for his glory. Well, when Dave left off, last time that he preached on this a couple weeks ago, we were at the end of chapter 4. And to catch up a little bit, in case you've missed some of our series on this, the end of chapter 4 is a very big deal. At this point, we now know, we had people calling out with Haman, so you can if you want to, but you can also avoid that if you want to too. We had Haman who had orchestrated this complete annihilation of the Jews. And the king, who was part of this whole thing, really had signed, sealed, and delivered on it. And it was such a big deal that they too went and had beer afterwards. Really, a nothing moment in the life of the king. These people were people that were no good, potentially terrorists, people that were causing problems amongst his kingdom. Wipe them out, move on. They're a faceless group of people we need to deal with, and move on. Now, we know this king is not a king that is a wise king in some senses. He's very full of himself. He is all power in the known kingdom. At one point, he even whipped the oceans because they weren't obeying him. This is how full of himself he is. In his world, everything is about himself. Now, this edict has gone out, and Mordecai is sitting at the gate in ashes and mourning for this. And his niece, Esther, finds out why. And there's a little bit of conversation back and forth between the two of them about what should happen, but really it comes down to this. He tells her that you have been made queen for a reason, for such a time as this. What are you going to do with it? And Esther ends that chapter by saying, I am asking you to gather everybody to fast. Do not eat or drink, and the implication is pray. We will pray, not eating or drinking, and we will pray for 3 days and 3 nights. You do it, me and my servants will do it, and then I will go and see the king. A risk, because anybody that walks before the king that has not been invited, death is what is open to you. Nothing more and nothing less than death. So let's pick up our story. On the third day of the fast, Esther put on her royal robes and entered the inner court of the palace just across from the king's hall. The king was sitting on the royal throne facing the entrance. When he saw Queen Esther standing there in the inner court, he welcomed her and held out the gold scepter to her. So Esther approached and touched the end of the scepter. Now we read that like it's a nothing moment, don't we? We've heard this story before, but let's just for a minute put your mind in her position. This king, who's so capricious and willful, has not talked to her in 30 days. And she's about to walk into his courtroom and hope and pray that by some luck he'll be facing her and see her. Because if he doesn't, it's over before she even starts. That by some luck he'll be willing to listen to her. By some luck, he'll want her there. Luck. But she spent 3 days and 3 nights praying and listening and moving into this. And she walks into this place, I am sure terrified, but knowing that life and death were not in the hands of the king, but rather in the hands of the creator. Then the king asked her, what do you want, Queen Esther? What is your request? I will give it to you, even if it's half the kingdom. Bold statement, kind of like saying to somebody, I'll give you the world for whatever you want. And Esther replied, if it please the king, let the king and Haman come today to a banquet I have prepared for the king. The king turned to his attendants and said, tell Haman to come quickly to a banquet, as Esther has requested. So the king and Haman went to Esther's banquet. And while they were drinking wine, the king said to Esther, "Now tell me what you really want. What is your request? I will give it to you even if it is half the kingdom." "All right, fun, it's fun. You did your thing, you freaked us both out, you showed up in the courtroom. No, what do you really want? It's not to have dinner with me and Haman. Where is this going?" Esther replied, "This is my request and my deepest wish." Oh, he's listening now. He's waiting. "And if I found favor with the king, and if it pleased the king to grant my request and do what I ask," wait on bated breath, what's going to be the request? "Please come with Haman tomorrow to the banquet I'll prepare for you. Then I will explain what all this is about." Fascinating request, and one that had him intrigued. Also, one that many commentators wondered if that was really what she was supposed to do or if she just chickened out. I mean, really, the king is sitting there, he's got all power of your known world, and you have this pretty big request. Is this the right timing? Should I do this or not do this? But I have to believe that as the rest of the story plays out, it wasn't that she chickened out, it was that she was listening to what God had for timing. So as we leave the end of this, Esther is in her apartments probably still, and the king is headed back to his home, and Haman is heading home too. Haman was a happy man as he left that banquet. But when he saw Mordecai sitting at the palace gate, not standing up or trembling nervously before him, Haman became furious. However, he restrained himself and went on home. Then Haman gathered his friends and Zeresh's wife and boasted to them about his great wealth and his many children. He bragged about the honors the king had given him and how he'd been promoted over all the nobles and officials. "I am it, guys. I have everything I have ever wanted. Look at how much I have done." Then Haman added, "And that's not all. Queen Esther invited only me and the king himself to the banquet she prepared for us. And she's invited us to come and dine with her and the king again tomorrow. As if all this wasn't good enough and the king didn't think I was amazing and put me in charge of everybody, the queen noticed me. I am rocking this." But then he added, "But all this is worth nothing as long as I see Mordecai the Jew just sitting there at the palace gate." So Haman's wife Zeresh and all his friends suggested, "Set up a sharpened pole that stands 75 feet tall, and in the morning ask the king to impale Mordecai on it. When this is done, you can go on your merry way to the banquet with the king. It'll be all good and all over." So, of course, this pleased Haman. Oh, my goodness. And he ordered the pole set up. Oh, Haman is a character, isn't he? He's like the epitome of every evil bad guy in every movie. The one that just seems to have no redeeming qualities about him in anything. And as I was processing him and thinking about who he was and his character, I kept thinking he's like a black hole in his soul that he's desperately trying to fill over and over and over again with accolades and affirmation and power so that he feels good about himself. Which is why when there's one man, one insignificant little man that is staying there doing nothing when he comes by, it just gets him so strongly, because in his world, his need to be seen and to be revered and to be noticed, his whole identity is wrapped around that. And this man that won't do that reminds him again and again and again he's really not who he thought he was. And it kills him. And it's amazing how far he's willing to go, and maybe how far sometimes we're willing to go, to prove that who we think we are is enough to everybody. All right, so Haman's at his house, having these conversations, erecting a 75-foot pole. Probably about that tall, so that you could see it over the palace walls. So when this guy is stuck on it, everybody in the city is going to know about it. Esther's doing her thing, the king's in his sleeping space, and is having trouble sleeping. Now, potentially, it's because he's wondering what the queen's up to, still. I don't get this, what we're doing, but for whatever reason, he can't sleep. So he ordered an attendant to bring the book of the history of his reign so it could be read to him. What do you do when you can't sleep? Bring the most boring thing you can think of and read that. It'll help knock you out. In those records, he discovered an account of how Mordecai had exposed the plot of Bigthana and Teresh, two of the eunuchs who guarded the door to the king's private quarters. They had plotted to assassinate King Xerxes. What reward or recognition did we ever give Mordecai for this? The king asked. His attendants replied, nothing's been done for him. Huh. Who's in the outer court? The king inquired. As it happened, Haman had just arrived in the outer court of the palace to ask the king to impale Mordecai in the pole he'd prepared. So the attendants replied to the king, Haman is out in the court. Well, bring him in, the king ordered. So Haman came in. The king said, what should I do to honor a man who truly pleases me? Haman thought to himself, whom would the king wish to honor more than me? So he replied, if the king wishes to honor someone, he should bring out one of the king's own royal robes, as well as a horse that the king himself has ridden, one with a royal emblem on its head. Let the robes and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble officials. And let him see that the man whom the king wishes to honor is dressed in the king's royal robes and led through the city square on the king's horse. And have the official shout as they go, this is what the king does for someone he wishes to honor. Excellent, the king said to Haman. Quick, take the robes and my horse and do just as you said for Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the gate of the palace. Leave nothing out as you have suggested. In that moment, I wonder if Haman wanted to throw up. Literally, he's feeling pretty great about himself. He's going in there, he's got the pole ready to go, he's gonna ask the king, can we just impale the guy, it'll be all done. And setting this whole thing up for his own honor and glory, wouldn't that be amazing? To be on a horse and have this guy showing that and everything good, and it's for Mordecai the Jew. The one that has destroyed his day. Every day he goes out the palace gate because he will not revere him, because he will not help Haman keep this facade in his head that he's the greatest and the best at everything. So Haman took the robes and put them on Mordecai. He got to do it like he would. Honestly, this is not a win. And placed him on the king's own horse and led him through the city square, shouting, this is what the king does for someone he wishes to honor. You got to know, he wasn't doing it in a celebratory way. Over and over and over again. Afterward, Mordecai returned to the palace gate. Didn't go to Mordecai's head. He didn't look at this and say, all of a sudden, I'm something. He returned to the gate to do the job that he was called to do. But Haman hurried home, dejected, and completely humiliated. When Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends what had happened, his wise advisors and his wife said, since Mordecai, this man who has humiliated you, is of Jewish birth, you will never succeed in your plans against him. It will be fatal to continue opposing him. While they were still talking, the king's eunuchs arrived and quickly took Haman to the banquet Esther had prepared. In a moment of glory given to himself, the glory is gone and given to his enemy, and Haman is left. Left wondering at these turn of events, this fate that is coming against him, this newness that's there that doesn't make any sense. And even his family and friends have the smarts to say, look, if you keep pursuing this, whatever is going on, we can tell this is going to come against you. But really, the plans have been set in motion already. And there's not a whole lot that he can do to unfold or to stop the turn of events that are coming. Haman versus God. So the king and Haman went to Queen Esther's banquet. On this second occasion, while they were drinking wine, the king again said to Esther, tell me what you want, Queen Esther. What is your request? I will give it to you, even if it is half the kingdom. Queen Esther replied, if I have found favor with the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my request, I ask that my life and the lives of my people will be spared. For my people and I have been sold to those who would kill, slaughter, and annihilate us. If we had been merely sold as slaves, I would remain quiet, for that would be too trivial a matter to warrant disturbing the king. You want to know what I want? I want you to know that I am the face of the people that you wrote this about. That what you decided not only affects this nameless group of people, the other that you have taken apart, but it affects me and who I am. I love that she says, if it was just slaves, it wouldn't matter. Honestly, they've been in exile for so long, really, they can live with that. But they're out to kill, destroy, and annihilate us. And for that, I will come to the king about that. Who would do such a thing? King Xerxes demanded. Who would be so presumptuous as to touch you? Not touch them, not your people, but touch you, someone that I see in front of you. Esther replied, this wicked Haman is our adversary and our enemy. Haman grew pale with fright before the king and queen. Then the king jumped to his feet in a rage and went into the palace garden. He's livid. Absolutely livid. But what's interesting is you look back when Haman proposed this whole thing, we're not even sure that the king knew who Haman was talking about. It became a law that got passed around. But not once in what Haman said to him did he ever mention Jews or the Jewish people or give them a name. So you have to wonder how angry he is in the garden, whether it's just about himself and the things that he's done, how he's been duped and played, whether or not it's actually having a face of someone he knows now that makes the difference. It always makes the difference, doesn't it? When they're not just them, but they're someone we know. Someone whose story we know, somewhere that we connect with them. Not the other, but a face to the other. So whether it was feeling like he'd been duped, whether it was because it was affecting his own life now and his own wife, not sure, but he is livid. And he goes out into the garden to cool himself off or maybe plan what's going to happen to Haman next. Whatever it is, Haman's life is doomed. And he knows it. And he makes probably the biggest critical error he could make. Haman, however, stayed behind to plead for his life with Queen Esther, for he knew that the king intended to kill him. In despair, he fell on the couch where Queen Esther was reclining just as the king was returning from the palace garden. Could it get any worse for this guy? Really, fate caused all these things to happen. Well, the king's response is pretty, kingly. The king exclaimed, will he even assault the queen right here in the palace before my very eyes? And as soon as the king spoke, his attendants covered Haman's face, signaling his doom. It's all over for this man who wanted nothing more than glory and power for himself. Then Harbonah, one of the king's eunuchs, said, Haman has set up a sharpened pole that stands 75 feet tall in his own courtyard. Just putting that out there for you to know. He intended it to use to impale Mordecai, the guy you just blessed and said you're really happy with, the man who saved the king from assassination. Pretty easy decision. Well, then impale Haman on it, the king ordered. So they impaled Haman on the pole he'd set up for Mordecai, and the king's anger subsided. All the story wrapped up in a tiny, cute little bow. Except that it's not. I mean, we've taken care of Haman, the bad guy. We have an edict now, though, that can't be undone. So that's the rest of the story that we'll get into next week. I can't tell you all the good parts of the story. You finish it yourself. But as I was thinking and processing this whole thing, I think it was so striking, all the things that happened by fate, that just seemed like life circumstances were moving. Esther alone becomes queen. Queen of a kingdom that is a pagan foreign kingdom that has nothing to do with her own cultural way of doing anything. She has no choice in the place that she's called into, and you have to know at some point there would have been big amounts of grief for her with that. All the process of a year preparing for one night with the king, and then becomes the queen of the known world. And then this whole situation arises, and then she's given a choice to do something or not do something. And so she walks into the courtyard of the king, and he is turning and looking at her, and he says that she's okay, and she's not put to death. Then we have a sleepless king who somehow ends up with the right book, the right page, the right conversation to honor a man that needed to be honored, that would slowly dismantle Haman's rule. Over and over and over again, in a book of the Bible where God's not mentioned, we see God's fingerprints on everything. Moving, shifting, changing, doing what he is going to do, even amongst a pagan, not God-honoring culture. And it occurred to me, one of the biggest lessons I can learn from Esther is just that. We live in an increasingly pagan culture around us. It used to be we could say that the culture around us was at least built on or on the foundation of biblical principles, of morals, of Christian sense of humanity and rights and freedoms. And slowly we are ebbing and changing and shifting away from that foundation. Human trafficking, it's funny because there was a war in the States, you might have heard about it, over slavery. It's a big deal. Human trafficking now is over a $1 billion industry of selling slaves. Abortion, where millions of children die every year around the world. We live in a culture that is increasingly not Christian culture. But I think we make a mistake when we assume that God is not still at work. He is moving amongst the culture that we're in. And when we're called to step in it, it's called to do things that push us, I think we need to be like Esther, to spend some time in prayer, listening, and then be willing to give up everything. Lives, jobs, reputations, whatever it is, because we're not giving it up for a single thing. We're giving up whatever God's called us into, knowing that God's got it. That he calls us into these places because he's moving and doing and shifting. And then no matter how dark our culture gets, he's still working. It's almost weirdly encouraging. Because the darker things get, the lighter the light of Jesus shines. In this room, if it was completely dark and I stuck a candle right in the middle with the littlest, tiniest flame, you would all see it. We have an opportunity to continue to speak and to shine the light of Jesus and to know that God's still working and moving. He may deal with our country. Ian said in the first sermon, he doesn't have eternal patience for countries that have walked away from him. But it doesn't mean he's not moving in hearts and lives, and that we're not called to be a part of that dynamic change. Processing, I want to say the next thing, and I don't think I do. But I'm thankful that we live in a time where we get to have the opportunity to see change and to be the lights that God's placed us to, and not to see things as accidental or coincidence or by fate that we ended up in the jobs, the schools, or the places that we're in. Will you pray with me? Father, we thank you so much for the story of Esther. We thank you for how you tied up all the loose ends and made it an unbelievable story. We thank you that in the midst of seeing our culture do things that are uncomfortable and that we are not liking, that we know you're still in the move and that you call us to pray. Call us to pray and to be surrendered to the things that you'd have us to do. We may not have the ability to move mountains like Esther did in the position she's in, but every one of us has influence. Every one of us has a place that we can bend the knee to you and step out for you. Would you show us what that looks like? Would you call us into those things? And would you remind us that we never walk with the things you call us to by ourselves? I ask all these things in your name, Jesus. Amen.